Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, April 5th. We begin with this. The really interesting Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell on the Biden infrastructure bill, why it seems to pay for itself eventually, but Catherine Rampell would rather a tax hike on a few more people to pay for it more quickly, and also how much of the Biden infrastructure bill is about infrastructure. You know, this is becoming a primary talking point for Republicans who oppose the bill. For example, here's Missouri Senator Roy Blunt yesterday on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
There's more in the package, George, for charging stations for electric vehicles, $174 billion, than there is for roads, bridges, and airports and ports. When people think about infrastructure, they're thinking about roads, bridges, ports, and airports. That's a very small part of what they're calling an infrastructure package that does so much more than infrastructure.
Senator Roy Blunt on ABC This Week. Here's Biden's Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg responding to critiques like that on Fox.
We're talking about roads and bridges. We're talking about rail and transit. We're talking about airports and ports. As you mentioned, we're talking about things like the grid. I don't know why anybody would say it's a mistake to invest in the grid after what we just witnessed in Texas. We saw U.S. citizens living in Texas melting snow in their bathtubs to be able to flush their toilets in the United States of America. That is unacceptable. So yes, infrastructure includes energy infrastructure. You know what else is part of infrastructure now? Broadband. I'm proud of the fact, even though it's a little outside my lane on the transportation side, I'm proud of the fact that we're going to finally get broadband out to every American, because we know, especially in rural areas, how much that's cutting people off from opportunity.
So there's Pete Buttigieg. A Washington Post fact check concludes that if you count transportation and broadband and utility grid investments, 24% of the bill goes to traditional infrastructure, 24%. If you add housing, schools and colleges, child care facilities, and federal buildings, including VA hospitals, it's 54%. Now, that still leaves a lot on what they're calling the human infrastructure or human services side, but a majority of the money can be called infrastructure spending in the brick and mortar plus broadband sense, says the Washington Post. And with that, we welcome Washington Post syndicated opinion columnist Catherine Rampell. She's also a political and economics commentator at CNN and special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. She even used to be a theater critic, and one of her recent columns is called, "I Knew I'd Miss Theater When Broadway Shuttered. I Didn't Know I'd Miss Audiences." Hi, Catherine. Always great to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to join you again.
So before we get into all this economics and infrastructure politics, you want to give us a quick thought on what you as a theater person have missed about audiences, not just the plays?
Sure. I knew in advance, I think, that I would miss the diversion of theater and, you know, the ability to sort of exalt in human talent and, you know, beautiful singing and exuberant dancing and great monologues and writing and all of that. But I think a year ago, if you had asked me whether I would miss audiences, I would have laughed. In the sense that audiences probably only really registered with me to the extent that somebody like misbehaved around me. You know, they crinkled a candy wrapper, or they coughed really loudly, or they obstructed my view, or what have you. And I think I didn't really appreciate at the time what a social experience it is to be a member of an audience. I just took that for granted, that when you're there in the theater, part of the intrinsic part of the experience or an intrinsic part of the experience is laughing along with other people and sobbing along with other people and sometimes having a completely different interaction or reaction to what's going on stage than your fellow theater patrons, and then arguing with them during the intermission. So, you know, I think that there's really a value there in that collective experience. And watching the performers play off of the audience and the audience members sort of feed off of the energy of each other, that I now am much more cognizant of. In the same way that I think I've heard other people who are sports fans talk about how they miss going to live athletic events, in part because they get to cheer along with fellow fans or, you know, boo or what have you. And that social experience is really valuable in a way that maybe we took for granted before.
Meanwhile, your column last week was headlined "How Biden's Tax Pledge Undercuts His Own Initiatives." Want to take us there?
Sure. So Biden has proposed a number of new visions for what government should be doing, not just on infrastructure. You mentioned infrastructure earlier in the show, but he's also talked about expanding the social safety net, having a more robust welfare state, providing greater subsidies for things like child care, paid family leave, et cetera. And, you know, I think my own politics are that I think these are worthwhile initiatives, and for the most part. But to the extent that the conversation has been about, oh, Biden is presenting a new vision of government, one in which it's more, you know, New Deal-like or more Great Society-like or bringing us back to the pre-Reagan era where big government could be a solution and not just the problem, I think that's only kind of half true in the sense that there is a lot of popular support for a more robust role for government, for the shared benefits of more generous government services, but not so much robust support for the shared sacrifice, or at least shared financial responsibility for paying for those kinds of, you know, expansions of government. At least that's the calculation that Biden mm-hmm. seems to be making, because he has restricted the pay-fors, and he said that he wants to pay for the things he wants to do, or at least partially. He's restricted that to corporations and the wealthy. And my own view is that, yes, corporations and high-income households should be paying more in taxes. They've gotten a lot of tax cuts over the years, and inequality has grown. So those two things combined suggest that they're, you know, shouldering less of the burden than they could. But if you look at the magnitude of the kinds of things that Biden wants to do, it's going to be really hard to actually fund all of these things solely on the back of higher taxes for the wealthy.
So, for example, Obama defined wealthy, you say, for tax rate purposes as $250,000 a year or more. Biden defines it at $400,000. You know, we can get lots of calls from families raising kids who'll say, yeah, I'm doing well at $250,000, but I'm upper middle class, not rich. In New York or New Jersey or Connecticut or San Francisco or LA's cost of living, what would you say to them?
Well, look, it is true that it's more expensive in New York or in San Francisco or other places with a high cost of living. But objectively speaking, those people are still towards the top of the income distribution, even in those places. There is a fraction of people who make a ton more money. So, you know, if you're comparing yourself to the Joneses, if the Joneses around you are hedge funders, you're not going to feel as rich. But that's, you could just look at the data, you know, that's the case. And I think the argument that I would like to hear Biden making, essentially, is that these programs are valuable, and we will make sure that the very high income people and corporations pay their fair share, which we don't think that they've been doing, et cetera. But we should all be invested in the financial success of these programs. And if we want to have a welfare state that looks more like those in Scandinavia, say, you look at how their tax system works. And in those places, in Sweden, in Denmark, it's not just that the tax rates are higher, but they're much more broader based, that even the middle class pays higher tax rates there than they do here. The middle class here actually pays relatively low tax rates compared to many other industrialized countries. So, you know, that's the trade-off that we're making. If you want more government services, yes, make sure that high-income people, that the very highest income people pay their fair share, but people at the $200,000 mark, the $250,000 mark, maybe even the $150,000 mark, they will probably need to foot some of the bill as well through some broader based taxes. And that doesn't necessarily even mean income taxes, right? I mean, there are other reasons why imposing this constraint is probably a bad policy move, not just for revenue, including that. For example, if we really want to get serious about climate change, there's almost unanimous support for among economists for the idea of a carbon tax as the most effective way to reorient our economy towards more climate-friendly technologies. And if you say nobody who's making under $400,000 can pay a dollar more in taxes, you've effectively ruled out a carbon tax or even a gas tax, which the Biden administration has said that they're not considering right now, even though that did have bipartisan support and has funded infrastructure in the past, still does. So I think there are a lot of reasons to say, look, we're all in this together. We should still have a progressive tax system. But if you want a more robust government, you're going to have to pitch in a little bit more. I know you don't feel rich, but that's just how the math works out. You know, there are just too many constraints to satisfy. Otherwise, you can say, okay, maybe we just won't pay for it, and that may be where we end up. But as I said, the Biden administration, I think to its credit, has said we are going to try to pay for these things.
Catherine, what about corporate taxes? Biden is trying to be a moderate here too, by his lights. Trump lowered the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Biden would bring it back halfway to 28% and add what he calls a corporate minimum tax and a tax on overseas profits. What do you think of the corporate tax changes that he's proposing?
I think as a policy matter and a political matter, there are pretty strong cases for doing this. The statutory tax rate before was probably too high. But there were a lot of statutory tax rate, meaning what the book said corporations had to pay at 35%. That was higher than what companies in other countries pay. However, there are so many loopholes and deductions and complications in the tax code that their effective tax rate was actually much lower than that. And I think there was some value to bringing down the statutory tax rate and broadening the base, simplifying it. Unfortunately, in my view, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act under former President Trump lowered the rate but didn't really do much in the way of base broadening. I think there's value to bringing that rate up, ideally doing some sort of simplification. And, you know, as the Biden folks have argued, the rate that Trump delivered was actually lower than a lot of companies were even asking for. So maybe there's some happy middle ground here. And as I said, I mean, this is, you know, they're not just sort of like revenue reasons for doing this. I'm not terribly worried about this scaremongering from Republican politicians that if you raise the corporate tax rate, you know, that'll destroy jobs, et cetera. I think the evidence on that is not particularly strong. You know, at least within the range of tax rates that we're talking about here. But besides the policy merits, politically, it is definitely a slam dunk. As I said, the idea of raising taxes on higher income people and corporations is extremely popular, has long been extremely popular. This is true even among Republican voters, not Republican politicians, of course. So, you know, I think that that is a fair place to begin to pay for many of these initiatives, even if I think ultimately if we're going to make a more permanent structural change to the role of government, it will probably require, a value-added tax or some other broader-based tax system.
Do you happen to know, by the way, I don't think that you've written about this that I've seen, but do you happen to know how a corporate minimum tax would work? Because that's in there, and I'm sure it's a very interesting concept to a lot of our listeners. You know, we do hear these outrageous horror stories sometimes about this mega corporation or that mega corporation that wound up having a zero corporate income tax bill because of the way they can manipulate the books legally. Do you know what a corporate minimum tax looks like under Biden?
You know, You know, I don't know exactly what it would look like, and I'm not sure that they've put out sufficient details. One of the challenges with any kind of policy proposal like this is what gets defined as income. and that's where you can play a lot of games with the tax code, whether you're a corporation or an individual. But if you're a mega corporation, you probably have a pretty deep bench of tax attorneys and accountants on call who can help you, you know, legally manipulate the books. So it may be worth pursuing. I think it's going to be more complicated than people think to say, okay, we're going to have a minimum tax rate. You know, if you have a minimum tax rate, I'm just making this up, of like 20% or something, but a corporation says, but we lost money last year, and they can legally, you know, get the math to work out that way, then 20% of zero, well, you know, because they're claiming no income, is still zero. Zero. So I think it's going to be challenging, but I would defer to the tax practitioners within our listenership who may have more specific guidance on that. But that's just my instinct.
Jennifer in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on WNYC with Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for taking my question. First, I have to say, I'm a Democrat, practically a socialist. I absolutely believe in paying my fair share. I absolutely believe that this is a way for a just and fair society to exist. So paying more in taxes, you know, doesn't bother me. But my husband and I live in New Jersey, and we make a low six-figure salary. And by all intents and purposes, we're doing quite well, except we're also burdened with the cost of living in New Jersey. And we live literally paycheck to paycheck. I have to make very difficult decisions about what to buy for my family. It's tough. And I just wondered if, and I would be willing to pay more, but I just wondered if there wasn't a possibility of including the variable of cost of living in the calculation of income tax. I think you would get a lot more buy-in from middle-class people even, and upper-middle-class people, in lowering that income threshold from $400,000 to $200,000 or something like that, or $150,000 or $100,000, if there was that variable. If you're in a small town in the Midwest and you make what we make, you're doing a lot better than we are probably.
Yeah, it's a great question. Have they ever tried to index for cost of living in different parts of the country and federal tax rates, Catherine?
I'm not aware of a serious legislative proposal, by which I mean something that, you know, that closely, nearly made it into law that did that.
Do you think it could be done?
I think in theory it could be done. It would make the tax code more complicated, of course, right? Because people are paying different rates depending on which side of some geographic divide they live in. And I don't know how that would shake out politically. I think it's an interesting idea. We do index other kinds of things for cost of living in the tax code. For example, you know, if you're traveling for business and you take a per diem on your expenses, that I believe is still adjusted based on the cost of living of where you're going. If you're going to rural Ohio versus San Francisco, the amount you can deduct is different. So it's not like a completely novel concept.
Kitty in Manhattan has a question that several people are calling with. Kitty, you get to ask it, but we got about 20 seconds for you. Hi there.
Good morning. Love you. Anyway, it's the issue of that follows on what you just said about the IRS has been hollowed out. Does Biden have a specific plan to resurrect that and to get some smart lawyers who can outfox the corporate lawyers who now get away with everything?
Kitty, thank you so much. And is it true, Catherine, as you understand it, that the way Trump hollowed out the IRS actually affects the ability to collect taxes?
Yes and no. It predates Trump.
Oh.
So over the last 10 years, the IRS's budget has been hacked away at. This basically goes back to, I want to say, 2011 or so. So it's, you know, sort of rise of Tea Party era, and partly connected to that scandal that you may remember about auditing groups that had Patriot in the title or what have you. Right. That was kind of the excuse. So the IRS has been hollowed out. Its budget has fallen, I think something like 20% in inflation adjusted terms. I forget the exact number. And they've lost a lot of their enforcement officials, their auditors, for example, the people who specialize in auditing complex tax returns in particular, which are the tax returns usually filed by large corporations and high income individuals individuals or households. So audit rates for the wealthy and for big corporations have plummeted. And as a result, we are probably leaving a lot of money on the table, just because if you are a tax cheat and you are actually breaking the law, your chances of getting caught have gone down. And the tax law is, you know, has enough gray areas that even if you're not outright cheating, but you're taking a really aggressive position on what counts as income or what's a deductible, you know, a valid deductible expense, et cetera, you know that the IRS is outgunned and they're probably not going to audit you. Or if they do, they're just going to be outmatched because you have, you know, tons of tax attorneys at your disposal. So all of these things put together suggest that we're leaving a ton of money on the table. The size of the tax gap was already quite large. The tax gap meaning the difference between what we're supposed to be collecting and what the IRS is actually collecting was already quite large. It's probably gotten larger. There's some research suggesting that there's probably more money being hidden offshore by rich people than we even thought. So all of those things put together suggest that, yes, this is a great example of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You cut the IRS, they become a less effective enforcement and revenue collection agency, and you end up losing out on money in the process. The Treasury has estimated that every additional dollar that could be spent on the IRS would probably collect another $6 in revenue, wow, just in direct revenue, right, by catching people who owed more than they actually paid, mm-hmm, and would probably have some deterrent effect as well that's harder to measure because people might be more afraid of getting caught, and so they'd be less likely to cheat or, again, take really aggressive tax positions in the years ahead. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, great way to you know, get free money, especially, but also, you know, a great way, I think, to increase public morale about the tax system. If Americans feel like the very wealthy and corporations are not paying their fair share, which is generally what the polling data show, they are going to be more averse to having their own taxes raised because they say, hey, how come those guys seem to be getting away with murder? How come that big company is paying nothing in taxes? Or that rich person, I suspect, has been cheating on his taxes and hasn't been ponying up. Why should I have, yes, to pay my fair share?
And there we leave it. Always an interesting conversation with Washington Post syndicated columnist Catherine Rampell, who was also a political and economic commentator at CNN and special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. We also got a couple of good ideas for follow-up segments there. One to talk about how that $400 billion in home care assistance for the elderly on top of what we spend now would be spent and who that would actually provide home care or other services to, and also what a corporate minimum tax actually would be. So we will follow up on those things. Catherine, as always, great conversation. Thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us today.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.